Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. I wanted to take a bigger picture view on the show this week. We're often focused on the war in Ukraine and conflict in the Middle East, but meanwhile, the risk of something even more dangerous, a great power conflict, could actually be higher than it's been in decades. Think about it. America's in relative decline. China and other countries are rising. The post-Bretton Woods order is being challenged. And amid this, diplomacy has gotten weaker and communication between militaries is declining. The risk of a big mistake is high. That's the theme of a new book, The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. The author of that book, Jim Sciutto, argues that 2024 could be another 1939. In other words, there are many similarities between the period we're in and the years leading up to World War II. Now, as I told him, there are many differences between then and now, including the fact that all those countries that were then colonized now have a lot more agency. They actually want a new world order because they feel the old one failed them. But even so, Sciutto's point is that any change could be incredibly violent, and that's why he's raising the alarm. Jim Sciutto is my guest on the show this week. He's CNN's chief national security analyst, and about a decade ago, he also served in government as the chief of staff at the U.S. Embassy in China. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can try us on video, live, on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too, and you can do that as well. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Okay, let's dive in. Jim, welcome to FP Live.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. So you start the book with a pretty scary moment. You're sitting in Bill Burns' office. This is the director of the CIA. And he tells you, we're playing without a net. In other words, a lot can go wrong. The great powers built a system of hotlines and treaties and multilateral organizations that once functioned. Bill Burns is telling you that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes, and it's one of the real dangers of this. And it's one of the reasons that this return of great power competition is arguably more dangerous than our last truest experience of that during the last Cold War, and that a lot of the infrastructure built during the last Cold War to avoid great power conflict from getting hot, nuclear arms treaties, hotlines, etc., they either don't exist anymore or they have been whittled away over time or never existed. Because the other piece of this that's different in the instead of having the US and Russia, two great powers, you have three with China. And with China, for instance, there are no nuclear treaties yet, even as it vastly expands its nuclear arsenal. There are no treaties for cyberspace. There are treaties for outer space, but those are not successfully regulating the emergence of space-based weapons, as we saw most recently with this U.S. intel assessment about Russia wanting to put a nuke in space. So you have, that is the net that we don't have, to Burns' words. And it's one of the reasons that I'm with this book trying to raise the alarm to some degree, right? That we have to acknowledge the raw great power conflict that is going on right now, and the dangers that exist to escalating that conflict.
So I'm lingering a bit on the title of your book, the return part of the return of great powers, because one could argue that, you know, Russia, by many metrics, whether it's GDP, whether it's population size, so many other things that you examine when you think about a great power, it wouldn't necessarily be defined as such.
Well, listen, Russia is not great in economic terms, in demographic terms. It does, though, have the world's largest nuclear arsenal, which gives it the capability to destroy the world if we were to get to that But it also has an extremely large military, which notably, as we've seen in Ukraine, the Russian leader is willing to use to, in this case, redraw the borders of Europe. And he's willing to not just sacrifice many tens of thousands of Russian soldiers and a lot of equipment as well, but also kill Ukrainian soldiers and deliberately target Ukrainian civilians and burn down Ukrainian cities and civilian infrastructure. So it may be a rotten great power, but it certainly has the tools to play in a great power landscape on a number of fields of play, if you want to call it that, really battlefields, and not just nuclear. It has a tremendous cyber capability. It has a tremendous space weapons capability developed over time. It has highly capable submarines, which are really the weapon of today and tomorrow when it comes to the projection of naval power as the age of aircraft carriers, et cetera, has probably peaked, probably past that peak. So it has a lot of great powers, even with its severe weaknesses at home.
You know, you've done a lot of reporting on sort of undersea capabilities, and I'm curious how you assess Russia's capabilities on that front vis-a-vis those of other countries and why that's important.
Well, let's tell you, I'm just going to lean forward here because on my desk I have a little beaker of water from under the Arctic, which I got on a trip with a U.S. nuclear submarine during the ICEX exercises under the Arctic. This was back in 2018. I didn't go swimming, by the way. They took some of that in the torpedo tube and gave it as sort of a gift of a rite of passage. But during those exercises and since then, got a vision into what is a, I don't want to say new, but a renewed cat and mouse game between U.S. and Russian naval submarine power. Particularly, well, in the Arctic, but not confined to the Arctic, because we certainly see increased Russian submarine activity down through the Atlantic. And their technology is great. U.S. submarine commanders will claim the U.S. still has the edge, but they're losing the edge in terms of detecting Russian submarines. They're quiet and therefore able to, at times, and there have been instances of this, some of which I recount in the book, where they were able to get past the net of U.S. Sensors, et cetera, which is, of course, it's a danger, right? Because nuclear submarines are a first strike capability. You know, you get off the coast of New York or anywhere, really, and you can launch with seconds and therefore no chance to respond. Not to say they're going to do that or that's the U.S. assessment tomorrow, but it does give them enormous power to do that. And, you know, post-collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia let many branches of its armed forces rot. But it kept its submarine forces capable, I mean, not perfect, but capable. And since then, particularly in the last 10, 20 years, has invested enormously in them and introduced new both boomers, you know, ballistic missile submarines and attack submarines that we haven't seen before that are quieter and more capable. So again, you know, I ask U.S. submarine commanders all the time, are they better than us? And they'll say, no, we're still better than them, but they're getting closer. And it's an open competition. China is behind. They're not as advanced, certainly, particularly in nuclear-powered submarines, but getting better and making an investment. And one piece of this no-limits partnership, as described by Russia and China that we see, and I talk about this in the book as well, is a concern that as China has helped Russia, buying its oil, for instance, as its European market disappeared, providing a lot of technology, if not explicitly military technology, to Russia in Ukraine, mm-hmm. still a lot of technology to back it up. The concern is that China's quid pro quo will be about that submarine technology you have, and that would be quite a dangerous collaboration.
And, you know, part of the framing of your book is, you know, also how China wants to control the global order. Russia kind of wants to blow it up. But these two countries, as you said, they're aligned in the moment, but they're also aligned in part out of opposition to the United States and its leadership of the world order. And so has Washington erred in some senses in allowing these two countries to come closer together?
Well, listen, you're right that it's, you know, it's largely a marriage of convenience, right? They cede a shared strategic interest in undermining the U.S. and at a minimum, undermining the rules-based international order as constructed today and as led by the U.S., because they see, and we should acknowledge it, they see it as one that is fundamentally in the service of America's interests and the interests of its allies, as opposed to Russian or Chinese interests. Now, U.S. officials I speak to in the book, Secretary Blinken and others, make the point, and this is not an undue point, that frankly, Russia and China have benefited from that system as well. China's economic rise certainly supported and enhanced by open shipping lanes in Asia and a trading relationship with the U.S. and rule of law, et cetera, where it holds. So still, though, they calculate strategically that the current one doesn't serve their interests and holds them back, in effect. So to the extent that they can together undermine that system and weaken the U.S., that's great. And they'll do that. And we see that more and more. Is it a boundless partnership, a no-limits partnership? There are limits. There's no question, even though they don't say it. They have their own competition out east, territorially, etc. Bill Burns talks in the book about how, you know, Russia better be careful about becoming the junior partner in this relationship, right? More dependent on China than China is on it, which, you know, Russian leaders, by many accounts, are aware of. So they're conscious of that too. But still, on balance, it's better for them, they calculate, to be working together against the U.S. for as long as that lasts, right? I mean, the conditions can change over time.
Mm. Well, let's talk about one of the limits in this no limits partnership. So one of the more dramatic parts of your book is how the world escaped a potential nuclear incident in 2022. Walk us through that. What happened?
So this is late summer, early fall 2022, and there were a combination of factors that led the U.S. to assess that Russia was very seriously considering a tactical nuclear strike in Ukraine. So use of a tactical or battlefield nuclear nuke, of course, much smaller than the nukes that can take down cities, but still quite devastating, and devastating in other senses, in that you would break the seal, in effect, on nuclear warfare many decades after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the combination of indicators at the time were a few things. One, Russia was losing ground in southern Ukraine. They were losing Kherson and lost Kherson, which was its biggest prize territorially of the invasion to date. There were thousands of Russian soldiers that were in danger of being surrounded as they withdrew from that area. And the U.S. assessment of Russia's nuclear doctrine, which, by the way, is imperfect because it's not entirely transparent, was that Russia might, under those circumstances, feel a military need or calculate a military need to use a tactical nuke to head off further losses, because they would see them as a threat to the state, to Russian territory, even though, of course, it was Ukrainian territory, but they claimed that it was Russian territory. That was one piece. At the same time, Russian leaders started to spread this fiction that Ukraine was planning a dirty bomb attack in southern Ukraine, a radiological attack. And you had Sergei Shoigu calling up his counterpart saying this. They sent a letter to the UN. Now, the US and its allies did not believe this was true, but they were concerned that this was a false flag to either justify a Russian nuclear strike or claim that it was actually the Ukrainians that were responsible if there was, say, a radiological attack of some sort. In addition to that, Russia, you know, in the weeks leading up, had been speaking very openly about it'd been rattling the nuclear saber, which we'd heard them do before, but they threw that into the mix and said, okay, we've got a problem. Plus, finally, the final piece was intercepted communications of Russian commanders talking about this very possibility of moving nukes into place and the possibility of a nuclear strike. So that led to, as one official, senior U.S. official I spoke to, led to them to prepare rigorously for this possibility. And that included U.S. officials meeting with or contacting their Russian counterparts. Bill Burns went to Turkey to meet Sergei Naryshkin. Mark Milley calls Gerasimov, Blinken calls Lavrov, etc., to say, basically, we see all this. What are you up to here? And don't think about a nuclear strike. You know, the world's response would be consequential. Allies doing the same. But then the final piece, which you were referencing in your question, is that the U.S. reached out to what Blinken described to me as unusual allies in this case, and that is China and India, allies in this effort that they believed Russia would listen to more. And in the U.S. assessment, and some of this is in the public record, public statements by Xi and Indian leaders at the time, was that they did get on board and pushed Russia quite directly not to do this. And you have public statements from Xi when I believe Olaf Scholz was visiting Beijing at the time. You have public statements from the Indian foreign minister at the UN. You even had a cancellation of a meeting in India that was planned, all part of this mix to say, don't even think about it, which Blinken and others told me they believe made a difference. They made a difference in heading this off. Since then, it hasn't entirely disappeared. They continue to worry that in certain circumstances, Russia might consider that. But boy, it was close. It was close by their account. And it's just a reminder of how the ingredients for escalation are there.
And it strikes me that of all the levers that the United States had to deter Russia, there was, you know, obviously direct communications with the Russians, but it seems like what might have moved the needle in the end the most was America's ability to speak to India and China and get them to exert some pressure. And of course, as this is going on, India and China are also ramping up purchases of Russian oil. So, you know, in India's case, for example, at the start of 2022, I think India was getting just 1% of Russian crude, and now it's upwards of 50% of Russian exports. India and China combined take about 80% of Russian exports of crude. How much of this do you think is India and China's gamesmanship versus any other sort of real fears that Putin might have of, you know, angering Xi Jinping and Modi?
Well, let's just say that India and China, by doing that, are saving the war in Ukraine for Russia, right? Because that is funding the war. The economy, the Russian economy couldn't withstand this if they didn't find other buyers for its crude. So they, you know, if Beijing has made a decision not to openly send tanks or artillery shells to Ukraine, they are sending money, in effect, for Russia. And not just for the war effort in Ukraine, but for propping up Putin's leadership. And it's, you know, they might argue it's in their interest. I mean, my understanding is they're getting it at a discount, right? And, you know, cheap energy is a good thing for economic growth, I suppose, but it has other costs. So it's something of a, I mean, they make their own calculations, right, in the midst of this. And, you know, might say, if we had one of them on the call right now, they might say, well, you know, we have not sent tanks and artillery shells. And, you know, we've urged all sides to come to an agreement, blah, blah, blah. And China has spoken about its own peace plan for Ukraine, et cetera. Of course, if you ask the Ukrainians, that they don't buy that either India or China is a fair interlocutor on this, in part because of the support that they're giving Russia. So we're giving Russia for its effort in Ukraine.
I'm getting some great questions from people who are listening in live on this show. One of them is Wes Clark, who I think is former General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. And he asks you, Jim, where did Putin's red lines come from? Was this from CIA Director Bill Burns's meetings in Moscow?
Red lines. I wonder, is he speaking specifically about the nuclear incident?
I imagine that's part of where he's going. Yeah. Yes,
it's interesting. When I spoke to Burns, I spoke to Milley about his conversations during that time period about how what Naryshkin and Gerasimov came back with. They certainly didn't admit that Russia was planning a nuclear attack. They didn't, though, definitively say absolutely not. Or at least Burns and Milley, in their telling to me, did not leave the room fully confident that that was off the table, right? Now, both of them acknowledged that that could be, you know, part of an influence op, right? To sort of, well, leave a little bit of doubt in their minds, which might serve their interest to keep the U.S. on its uncertain footing. By the way, I did speak, General Clark, to folks in Europe who had a different view of this time. And for instance, I speak at great length to the Estonian Prime Minister Kaya Kallas, who does not minimize the threat of a nuclear strike, including during this period. But she makes the point, as others have made, that we can overestimate as well Russia's nuclear threat, and that it's their view that Russia exaggerates it at times expressly to put us off balance and get us scared so that, well, do we really want to send this weapon system in? And listen, there's a lot of criticism in this book for the sometimes stop and start U.S. Support for Ukraine. We're going to send this weapon system, but not right away. Not this one. Well, maybe now. That kind of thing is not just impacting Ukrainian military operations on the ground, but also sending a, you know, also playing the Russians' game for them, right? Get it, you know, self-deterring. So I've heard a lot of that criticism as well. Listen, you're a leader in the Situation Room trying to support Ukraine while avoiding escalation to war with Russia. That's a tough, for any of us on this call, it'd be a tough road to navigate. But there's certainly a lot of criticism in this book that Western leaders have been too timid at times in their support for Ukraine. I hope that answers the question.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, which we often use, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up, use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's FPLIVE, one word.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's get to one of the other big analogies you draw in this book. We've talked about the Cold War, but 1939 and the lead up to World War II. Why do you think this is a 1939 moment?
I don't make that comparison lightly. And I'm aware that 1939 has been brought up at different times in our history. You know, you might have heard that around Saddam's invasion of Kuwait or comparisons of him to Hitler, etc. And by the way, I am not saying Putin is equivalent to Hitler. Putin has not carried out the Holocaust. He certainly has shown no reluctance to kill civilians wholesale in Ukraine, but it's not on the scale of the Holocaust. So let's set that aside for a moment. But in terms of what 1939 was, a revanchist leader in Europe, redrawing the borders of Europe by force of arms, and testing Europe to see how far they would let him go. And as you know, even a superficial reading of the history of the time was that there were those in America and Europe who said, well, just give him that peace and give him Sudetenland, all will be fine. Or maybe Poland's not our war either. And we know how far Hitler pushed things. And, you know, without the Battle of Britain, might have gone all the way to the UK as well. Putin has already shown his willingness to redraw the borders of Europe by force. In fact, absorb the largest country in Europe by population and land size by force, attempt to. And he's done it before. He sliced off a piece of Georgia in 2008. Two pieces of Ukraine in 2014, other attempts to, you know, via coup and cyber attack in Estonia in 2007 to subjugate, and now trying to slice off a piece of Moldova. So you have, you know, there's a lot of precedent for what he's willing to do. And there's also a lot of precedent for letting him take a slice and assume that will be the last piece, or hope that that will be the last piece, which is repeatedly belied by facts and the events that follow. Kaya Kallas, she frequently quotes Churchill on this and the crocodile to say an appeaser is the one who feeds the crocodile and hopes he or she will be its last meal. And she and many of our Eastern European facing partners especially believe that that precedent is true. And I think the record shows that. So that's why I feel you have the ingredients, and not just in Europe, by the way, because if you look at China's calculations vis-a-vis Taiwan, they're quite similar.
Yeah. And we'll come to China in a bit, but one bit that, just to push back a bit here, Jim, so 1939 was a dramatically different world, right? So large parts of the world were colonized. Many of those nations gave hundreds of thousands of soldiers to the war effort. And in a sense, that's what made it a truly world war. But in 2024, and we were riffing on this earlier, all of those countries are now independent. They have agency. They may not even want so-called great powers to have that much sway at all. They might not want great powers to be great in that sense of 1939. What's your sense of how that difference plays out in terms of 2024 being 1939?
Well, for one, it wasn't a world war immediately in 1939, right? It expanded from there. That was it started with Poland. I'm not saying that all the dominoes fall, the same number of dominoes fall, you know, in the wake of something like this. But I believe the ingredients are there. The dangers are there. I mean, the most obvious domino would be Taiwan. And for this book, I did not meet a single person, official, soldier, commander, politician in the U.S., Europe, or Asia who did not make a direct connection between events in Ukraine and events in Taiwan in terms of, you know, principally how Xi Jinping is watching this, looking at for the military lessons of Ukraine for Taiwan, but also for the geopolitical lessons. Will the world, will Europe, will the US allow it to happen? What are the costs economically, diplomatically? How long are those costs imposed? When does the West exhaust itself and just get bored of the conflict? All of which you can see happening right before our eyes right now. So if not identical, many of the same ingredients, I would argue. And I think, you know, I have a whole chapter on this where you have, while the world is not a world of colonies today, you do have a world of alliances that are growing, by the way. You have countries in Europe making military cooperation agreements with countries in Asia that they would not have in the past because they calculate that China is as much a threat to them in Europe as they are to these countries in Asia. You have the AUKUS agreement where Australia, after years of doing its best to engage economically and diplomatically with China, after China, frankly, pushed the limits too far in terms of interference, said, you know what, we're throwing in our lot with the US and the UK, and we need these nuclear submarines, et cetera. So, I mean, that's even a World War I comparison, right? Entangling alliances, if you look at the run-up to World War I. And by the way, and I'll cut it off after this, but I talk in this book about this moment in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when JFK deliberately had every member of his cabinet read The Guns of August, the run-up, the Barbara Tuchman story about the run-up to World War I, which by happenstance and maybe the grace of God had been published earlier in 1962. And the reason he did is he said as much to RFK, he said, I don't want someone to write a book, The Missiles of 1962, about decisions I've made here or others have made. I don't want to descend into conflict as we saw in World War I. I mean, the point being that, you know, the historical, there are many historical precedents here about when great power wars were avoided only narrowly, 1962 or not. And I think we can learn lessons from both those moments.
Yeah, at the very least, it's a warning and an interesting exercise. Another subscriber question. This one's from William Duncan. He's a longtime diplomat. He's now the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador. So he says of your World War II analogy that, you know, Germany could be Russia today in some senses. But why then is the world more or seemingly more worried about China? And he goes on to ask, what type of conditions Beijing might look for to start a great power conflict?
Well, China, for one, is it's an economic behemoth, right? By more recent estimates, not going to sort of swoop past the U.S., but reach a relative parity in size, while Russia is a fraction, depending on how you measure it, maybe the size of New Jersey's economy, right? So it's not. So China has the economic might, if not the nuclear arsenal to date, to be a more credible long-term competitor. that's the primary reason, but it's also vastly expanding in every field of play. Its cyber warfare capabilities are significant. Its space warfare capabilities are significant. Its AI capabilities rapidly progressing. It has an enormous economy, which can then back the development. And it's got a Navy bigger than the US and so on. So all those pieces make it a more formidable long-term competitor. But both of them dangerous in their own way, right? I mean, it's I'm not alone in describing China as the bigger long-term threat. That's generally the view you'll hear from intel officials, military officials, et cetera. But that doesn't mean Russia can't cause a whole heck of a lot of trouble in the meantime. And arguably might even be more dangerous in some way because it's not as invested in the international system as China is. China's economy is still very much dependent on US-China trade, which remains pretty robust, right? In a way that Russia is not. So it would be more damaging for China to dive in and say, invade Taiwan than for Russia, because Russia lost all of its energy customers in Europe, which is not insignificant, but it was able to replace that. China would be a lot harder. So
yeah,
on the one hand, more capable, on the other hand, more invested, and therefore a riskier bet for China, particularly now as its economy has slowed down.
Mm. So you're quite unique among reporters in that you actually served in government. You were chief of staff in the U.S. Embassy in China at a very interesting time in the 2010s, I think right before Xi Jinping came to power. You had the highest levels of security clearance. Looking back now, do you think the United States made a mistake in its China policy in the 2010s?
100%. Absolutely.
Okay.
I say this in this book, I said it in the Shadow War, that the U.S. grossly underestimated China's aggressiveness and its advance towards aggressiveness. And I described interactions I had during my time as chief of staff in the embassy. One, I'll give you an example. At that time was when China first got this aircraft carrier. Remember, they bought the hull from Ukraine, as fate would have it. But I remember there was a view in the embassy at the time, this is just it's a showcase military asset. China has no intention for a blue water navy, really doesn't want to go beyond the first island chain, etc. When in fact that was a sign, and look where we are today, 350 some odd ships and bases in Djibouti and this port in Sri Lanka and activities in the Arctic. So I think there was a strong misread of China's military intentions. There was a deep misread of China's intentions in the South China Sea. The U.S. basically got snowed by China. You'll remember, I mean, this was in the Rose Garden. Obama said that she promised not to militarize those islands. Well, China militarized those islands, right? And they're now unsinkable aircraft carriers in the South China Sea. That was a major misread. And even in my last book, folks who were involved in those decisions, I spoke a lot to the late Ash Carter in that book, they cop to it. They say that we, in his words, that we mirrored, you know, we looked at China and Russia as for too long as countries that wanted what we wanted, when in reality they did, you know, the status quo to them was not acceptable. So
Jim, I want to go a layer deeper here. So if America got things wrong, why do you think that was the case, and what needs to change? I mean, it's one thing to misread, but is it a misreading because America doesn't have the right intelligence? Is it because there aren't enough Chinese language analysts? What's driving this, and what needs to change?
Well, the way officials involved described it to me was it was this mirroring phenomenon. They looked at the situation, and even when there was a great deal of contradictory information, like efforts in the South China Sea or the Georgia invasion, or even public statements, right? Going back to Putin at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, when he laid this all out, or Xi Jinping and the Chinese military and their plans for military expansion. It was there for us to see and listen to, but we didn't want to see it to some degree. And again, don't trust me on that. Trust the folks I quote. I deal with it a bit in this book. I dealt with it more in the Shadow War, where they said they mirrored, they saw what they wanted to see when it came to Russia and China. Now, you can criticize, it's always, you know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback. In their shoes, you could understand the motivation to find a path forward and to engage. And by the way, the U.S. wasn't alone in this. Germany through nearly 20 years of Merkel's leadership, its policy was engagement with Russia. We could find a way. We have a partnership here. We have shared experience in the East and all that. And that blew up in their faces. And to their credit, they reversed, right? But, you know, not until a couple of years ago. So the U.S. was not alone in that miscalculation. And you can understand the motivation for it. You don't want to go in guns blazing and imagine that these guys, you know, were bound for war. And the truth is, today we don't want to do that either, right? To some degree, and in that you want to find ways to talk and to set limits, because momentum towards war can be a very powerful force.
Right. And, you know, in some senses, American policy towards China has dramatically changed since the years when you were in government. And I'm curious whether you think that change is adequate or has it gone too far? I mean, for example, you quote Matt Pottinger a fair bit in your book. He worked for the Trump White House. And of course, has a very hawkish sense of what China wants from the world. What's your sense of that? Where are we now?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's a rare bipartisan issue, right? Hawkishness on China, and you can look at that at just the makeup of the House committee, right? The way Democratic and Republican lawmakers on that committee speak about China is pretty much in lockstep, right? And it's the way the kind of American public sees it more and more. And it's, if you look at Biden and Trump's trade policy vis-a-vis China, a lot of sanctions, right? You know, some tariffs. So there's a lot of overlap on that issue that you don't see elsewhere. So I think that the view has definitely shifted, right? And in that direction, you know, the danger is you don't want to shift too aggressively in that direction, right? Because you don't want to goad on conflicts, right? You know, the Biden has talked about this a lot for years. You know, the worst war is the war you don't want, right? And you can set the circumstances that put you on a path to that. So I do believe it has changed, but I also think that we as a country, as our lawmakers, thinkers like we have on this call, think tanks, journalists, that we don't want to get caught in a situation where we talk about this purely in incendiary terms, because you can talk your way into conflict too. And on the good side, no one I spoke with, you know, there's no US or European intel assessment that either Russia or China wants great power war with the US, that they see the damaging consequences of that. They're willing to push the limits, God knows, and we see that, but they don't want that either. Mm.
Let's get to America. So you cover US politics a lot more than I do. I'm thankful for that. What would Trump's return mean for the world? What is a Trump 2.0 foreign policy?
It is, you know, this is for this election in the fall, whatever your politics, there is a hard definitive choice for how you want the U.S. to operate in the world, how you want it to behave with regards to its alliances, its allies. Biden represents what was until recently a bipartisan view, faithful to alliances, NATO, Japan, South Korea, etc., viewing Russia and China for what they are, which is countries that see it in their interest to undermine the U.S., right? And to stand up to that, not shoot at them, but stand up to that steadfastly. That's the Biden view that would have been quite similar under a George W. Bush or H.W. Bush administration and so on. Trump, and he's, again, don't trust me. I speak to several of his former senior advisors in the book, Kelly, Bolton, Pottinger, plus you have his public statements, either is not fully committed to America's alliances or might very well take the U.S. out of them in a second term. Or if you can't take them out of them because of congressional legislation, effectively neuter them. Because if the commander in chief won't abide by Article 5, then that NATO means nothing. He, according to Bolton and others, has very little interest or understanding of the U.S. defense alliance with South Korea or the presence of troops there, and might feel somewhat similar about Japan. He certainly has no interest in defending Taiwan. Bolton tells the story in the book about how Trump would sit at the desk in the Oval Office, hold up a Sharpie and point to the tip and say, "See that? That's Taiwan. See this desk? That's China," to make the point that Taiwan has no chance against China, therefore we have no business defending them or no interest in defending them. So under Trump, no defense of Taiwan, end of Ukraine aid. If not a withdrawal from NATO, a weakening neutering of NATO, a reduction in possible retreat from treaties with South Korea, Japan, and then a follow-on phenomenon of that, which I talk about in the book, which is that a lot of those countries then make a not unreasonable decision to go nuclear because they can no longer rely on America's defense umbrella, including its nuclear umbrella. And they look at Ukraine. What did Ukraine lack? Nuclear weapons post-1994. So it's a, you know, on that issue, it's not about marginal tax rates, right? It is a sharp 180 in the U.S. position in the world. And with all the consequences that that brings, I make a case in the book that, you know, we might imagine that we can retreat behind the ramparts and those are other people's conflicts, but we have all benefited from this boringly labeled rules-based international order in terms of free trade, the lack of great power competition, relative respect for borders and sovereignty, the ability to do business in these countries, open foreign offices in places that we didn't before, send our kids to semesters abroad in Eastern Europe. I mean, all these ways we, you know, those things would be potentially under threat. So a real choice in the fall.
We do indeed. You know, a lot of how we think about Trump and his foreign policy is through, you know, what his gut instinct is. And then we try to sort of decipher what that could mean. But part of how I think any human being forms a gut instinct is through what they read and who they listen to or who they watch in Trump's case. Who has his ear right now when it comes to foreign policy? You've spoken to many former Trump officials. I'm guessing many of them won't have a part to play in a Trump 2.0 White House. Who's he listening to now?
Goodness. Well, on immigration policy, Stephen Miller, and we should all sit down and listen to how Stephen Miller speaks about this country and what his vision is of this country and who's welcome and who's not. It's pretty stark. I've had face-to-face conversations with him. You got to be comfortable with that. All of us who are descended from immigrants, the only question is when those immigrants came, should understand exactly what they're talking about. On you know, China, I mean, I see Lighthizer's name floated. And he, by the way, was one of the architects of Trump's China policy in his first term.
This is Bob Lighthizer.
Bob Lighthizer. And he, listen, you know, I met him and I'm sure a lot of people on this call have too. To be frank, in terms of trade issues, not an enormous shift from where Biden administration policy has been. The national security stuff, I do think, would be different because Trump's view of the alliances in Asia is different. I think in terms of information bubbles, you know, even Fox News apparently isn't right enough for Trump because you see it in his posts on some issues when they do challenge him. So, you know, I don't know who would be his defense secretary, for instance. I don't know who would accept that job from the kind of Kelly Bolton category that did the last time around. I mean, people talk about Kash Patel. He's got quite aggressive views on the use of uniformed military at home, which would break norms that have held for more than a couple hundred years. We have to be willing to accept that. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, he's apparently making shortlists.
And we'll all be here to cover it. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. But Jim Sciutto, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. And thanks so much to all of you for joining. It's nice to be in touch.
And that was Jim Sciutto, CNN's chief national security analyst and the author of The Return of Great Powers. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. FP's spring magazine is about to drop. It's all about India. The elections there begin later this month. I've written the lead essay in that issue, and so I'm going to take viewer questions on the elections, on Narendra Modi, New Delhi's foreign policy, and what the country's rise means for the world order. Head to our website to send in questions. We'd love to hear from you. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin, and the executive producer of FP Live is Dana Shern. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, Small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.